At the beginning of a working day, I or somebody else, myself, might have to go to the office to collect the orders, which were in a bunch of labels called us name on one side, and the other side you wrote the name of the plant that was required. And these orders, the name of the plant would be written by the office staff, and you would identify the plant and put the label on it. And I'd go to the office, and it was a great, there was a great hierarchy there. Would be amazing today, but this huge desk at the top, a large desk, rather like a pulpit in a way, which Mr. Neal, the head office man, he was the what you call a chief accountant today, I suppose, and he was sat at this big chair, keeping everybody in order like the headmaster, you see, and he'd got a desk in front of him. And then all the lesser staff were all down each side of this table, some with typewriters and some without, some just
So
with.
how many staff were we, office staff, were we talking about then?
I can't be sure. I can't be sure because they varied, they came and went, and I would think there'd be eight or nine office staff. The office boy being that Frank Passenter, who became the company secretary or chief accountant, if you like. But that was it. There was very much, if there was chattering in the office, Mr. Neal was, "That's enough, quiet, please," and he would be completely. They would have seemed to be completely in awe of him anyway, but you wouldn't get that situation today in an office. But that was how it was.
Tell me about your what you were doing at that time then, because you've talked about digging up plants and doing orders and going to the office. What were your main roles during that time? What were you doing?
Well, I was just a general dog's body, quite honestly. But I worked with Eric Webber, who was the herbaceous foreman for a while, and he, I knew him years afterwards as well when he started a business on his own. But Eric Webb would say to me, "Can you go and get the orders and the labels from the office?" And then I'd go around with him. We'd both have spades in our hands, and we'd dig up and put them on the trolley, take them to the packing shed, and that was all day's work really. But then that went on virtually all winter.
What about the rest of the year then?
When
What were you doing?
it was frozen and we couldn't dig
No, of
anything
course
up,
not. No.
we were found jobs in the packing shed, either tidying it up. There was a big seed department, which I didn't have much to do with. There's a seed warehouse man as well, and I forget his name, but they supplied seeds, and nearly all nurseries did that.
Yes,
They don't now.
no.
It was quite usual for people to want Caldwell seeds with Caldwell's name, but they weren't fancy packets like you have today. They were just plain packets, Caldwell and Son Seedsman, Knutsford, and the name of the seed on the packet. And filling those, but they used to have fine balances, and some seeds, of course, were very, very small and light, and required very delicate balances. You were talking about grams and very minute quantities of seed, like begonias, of the smallest half a gram would cost quite a bit. And you have these little scoops on the end of a balance, and they were, you would pour these into the packet. It's all labour intensive, which would all be done automatically today. But that was a winter job.
Yes. What about summer jobs? Were you involved in sort of propagation or division and sort of things?
Yeah. Well, the big job, of course, again, before the winter was over, was taking cuttings.
Of course.
Mm-hmm. So the foremen were the ones who used to come back with a great bunch of wood into the shed when it was too cold outside to work, sort of thing. And we'd have to cut these into lengths. And then they'd be either planted or put into pots of the greenhouse. Obviously, there was a greenhouse section and a greenhouse foreman, Tom Cash being the man here. And the propagation went on really all winter. I have mentioned that the Dutch supplied briars for budding. But when there was never enough, they couldn't import enough during the war, and of course in the end of the war it was slow to start again. And the idea of getting stocks to bud the roses on, obviously they never seemed to strike roses from cuttings, which I do myself quite easily now.
Yes.
But it was easier to produce, it was far quicker to produce a big bush budded onto a dog rose, which was a wild stock, than it was to start from a cutting, which would take a few years before it got to a decent size. So that was the idea of budding. But I remember at the one of the early jobs when Mr. Caldwell Jr. came out of the forces. He'd been injured, actually, and I think he'd been a prisoner, I'm not sure. But anyway, he was sent by his father to collect hips. And actually, they used to pay school children, I believe, at a later date to do this. To collect rose hips from the hedgerows, because there was more hedges in those days and dog rose hedges, you know. And what we'd do, we'd collect all these rose hips in the autumn, and they would be put in boxes of sand in layers. They usually used a lot of heavy ammunition boxes from the war were popular. Layers of sand, probably three or four layers of berries in each box, and that was watered and then put outside to freeze or what have you during the winter. And the following spring, that mixture of berries and sand, berries have disintegrated, and so you got the little seeds would be mixed. We'd then mix them up, put them into a barrow, mix them all up, and then they'd be sown in a seed bed. And these little dog rose seedlings would come up. And when they were 12 months old, they could be planted. And the following year, they could be budded. But it was a slow business in those days. And as far as standards were concerned, I mean, later they would import specially grown standards of rugosa or whatever from Holland or Belgium or France in some cases. But to produce a standard when you got nothing to bud onto, I'd go with young Bill Caldwell in his little Ford car round the lanes of Cheshire, and we had to be sure that the farmer hadn't really seen us, and we would dig out from a hedge a nice, well, that's a good stem, Kemp, we'll have that one, you see, and get the spade out, and we'd dig these stems out of the hedge. And even, you know, we'd chop the roots up. They'd always root. They were tough things, you know, dog. And we'd take those back to the nursery, and those would produce a standard. You didn't get many of those, of course, available. And they could charge quite a lot of money for a standard rose, and that was the reason. But that was the only way you could get them. And that was done by the biggest rose nursery in the area, and the oldest nursery in the country, and that was dug surreptitiously like that. That was how they produced the standards. Yeah. Yeah. But later on, of course, it wasn't necessary because they would buy them in. Yeah. But you only got a certain quota allowed by the government to import to a certain value. Yeah. So if they wanted to increase that, we'd got to produce our own stock, you see.
Yes. Did you work in the greenhouse? You mentioned the greenhouse. The greenhouse.
That was mainly only in the winter when I couldn't work outside. The greenhouse stuff were mainly, there was enough of them, you know. But we did, one of the big jobs at the winter time was to make holly wreaths, of course, for sale in the shop. Which was a big thing, and in the winter time, we would be sent into the one of the greenhouses, which was a nicer job because it was warm, and we would have to moss up frames, which is how I learnt to do this thing, and wire frames would be mossed up, and then the more skilled eventually did learn to do it, but the more skilled men would have wired pieces of holly. Calder's had a lot of holly trees, specimens, but it was the landscape, the sort of outside workers' job. And a lot of nurseries did this, is send men out to these big houses and offer to cut, to prune, to trim, you know, because they had to be kept a nice shape.
Yes.
So what they did, we would stretch sacking or tarpaulin sheets under the holly, put your ladders up and clip them, and then you collect all the clippings up, take them back to the nursery, and those would produce the stock for wiring up and making the wreaths, and that was Christmas wreaths, you see. And they make hundreds of those, hundreds of those.
Yes.
Sometimes moss was very difficult to get at that time, and they'd use straw, which was harder to, because you couldn't stick you couldn't stab into it, and they used to have to wire the, just bind the holly onto the moss with wire, what they call a running on method. But, a nursery, even like Calder's, would send a wagon, probably some deliveries to do on the borders, but into Wales, into Llangollen. There used to be a hill that was famous for moss called Velvet Hill near Llangollen. And you'd be careful that not too many people saw you, but they would be sent with sacks to collect moss off a hillside, and bring it back to the nursery, you know. Later on, of course, moss was sold in the, or had been before the war, I suppose, in the wholesale market in Manchester. You got bags of moss. They only cost about a shilling in those days. But if you hadn't got enough, you'd go and scrounge it off the fields or wherever. That was the winter job. And then, of course, you'd got all these rooted cuttings and all these young plants in the spring to plant out. And that was a big job then. Yes. You'd go around with the with the trolley and the barrow, and the foreman, like Eric Webb, would have a list of how many he was he decided to allocate. Mm. And that was the tricky job, to know how much to produce.
Judging the market. And
how many Scabies, Clive Greaves, how many Erigerans, how many Deronicum, Harper Crew, those varieties, the popular varieties, they've got to assess how many. Hopefully have a surplus.
Yeah.
One thing that did upset me about it, I was always keen on growing rock plants, and they grew a certain amount of alpines. Yeah. And the unsold plants, because it had to be young stock, was sold to the public. But the old stock, they did have a stock bed for taking cuttings of alpines. Mm. But apart from that, the old ones that were unsold were put on a bonfire and burnt. And I made the mistake one day of asking old Mr. Caldwell if I could have or buy one or two of these plants that were on this bonfire. Mm. No, you can't. Those cost money. You can have one, but you can have it at the same price as we pay, and it was 1 and 6. But so it didn't matter whether I bought a good one in a pot or I took one off the bonfire. He wasn't going to reduce the price because he'd had to pay money and pay people's wages to produce it. And I was very disgruntled about that because it was an attitude he could understand in a way. But the old man, not his son, young Bill, was had a different attitude, you know. But he was a Victorian, the old man, and all working men were thieves, you know what I mean. And they were going to pinch it anyway, so you've got to get what you can when you can. And he just had that opinion. You knew that. And of course, you know what they say about give a dog a bad name. And of course, men used to walk out of that nursery all that in those days. They could hardly bend the legs because they'd got a tree or something or a bush stuffed down the trousers and covered over with the trousers, and they'd take it home to sell in the pub or to plant in their own garden because they weren't going to pay the boss for it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if he'd had a system that the staff could buy at a discount, he wouldn't have had to throw stuff away like that.
Yeah.
People would have been happy to do it. Which is done today, but not then.
Yes,
no,
yes.
No.
Mm. So tell me about the family. We'll come back to other things about the family then, because there was old Mr. William Caldwell, who was in charge, presumably.
He was definitely in charge when I was. Yes, yes, he was. I mean, he'd be possibly in his late 60s or early 70s when I got there. And again, he was a product of the old days. And he didn't think people worked as hard as they had done. I mean, I knew that by the men, the older men that worked there. He would fire people on the spot in the old days. And actually did do, until possibly until the late 40s or early 50s. And when there was such a shortage of labour because of the war, that he'd got to be a bit careful about how many he sacked. But in the pre-war days, he would, if somebody bent to tie their shoelaces, he would tell them that that should be done in their own time and that not at his time. Get down the road, here's your cards. And he would pick up the phone and ring the Labour Exchange, send two more men. Well, that was when there was queues of unemployed and people on the dole.
Yeah.
That was the 30s.
Yeah.
People don't realise how bad things were. And the top wage then, in 1939, was £1.19. And people were fighting for jobs at that money. Anyway, he had to be a little bit more careful later on, but he was in charge very much then.
Mm.
And his son, who was obviously about 6 or 8 years older than me, or he might have been 10 years older than me, possibly, he had to go in the army because they weren't food producers. They had no excuse.
Of course, yes.
And he, whether he had to go or whether he wanted to go is another matter, but he wouldn't have had any difficulty in going on. He became, he went in the tank corps, and he ended up in the vast tank battle, the Battle of El Alamein under Montgomery, and he was very badly burnt in the tank, and I think he was taken prisoner for a while. And his mother, of course, Mr. and Mrs. Caldwell lived on the nursery in those days on Chelford Road, and I suppose they would get a telegram like you did then, posted missing, possibly dead or believed dead, you know. And she had a very bad stroke. She was just so upset. And she was partly paralysed for the rest of her life. She was a lovely lady, a very nice lady, Mrs. Caldwell. Everybody liked her. She had a kind word to say for everybody, but she got an electric wheelchair in there, and she used to drive it round the nursery and talk to you, you know, and she couldn't walk, but she managed this. Obviously it was her legs that had gone. And her speech wasn't badly, well, it might have been initially, but it wasn't badly affected. She seemed to be able to talk all right. And then that was all I know about the family, really.
Did married. William take over while you were there, or was it still?
Well, he's still the old man, but he did take over. And I remember him getting married, and as I was introduced to it, I was invited to the wedding, but I didn't go because it was rather difficult. I lived in Point and it was in Knutsford, and I've had to have stayed overnight, and I didn't, you know, it was expensive to stay at the hotel. I declined, but I was invited actually. But his wife, Mavis, was Mavis Ann Bentley, and she was the daughter of Bentley's Fertilisers. It was a well-known fertiliser. I think it was Leicester Way, somewhere in the east. But about this time, can I go into the other room, please, for a minute?